This is a segment from the Annex Sociology Podcast. For more information, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. And now we turn to Vincent Rochegnaux from Ohio State. Vinny has a long and impressive resume and is now working on a new book, Inequality and Power in Everyday Life, with Polity Press. He's also a former editor of ASR, and he is now chairing an ASA task force on first-generation and working-class sociologists. We got a lot to talk about. Thank you for joining us, Vinny.
Hey, thanks for having me. Happy to make it to the Annex.
Well, you know, I mean, ASR and was just, you know, the warm-up act, right? I mean,
well, I was thinking about this, and I could be ASR editor, I could publish an article in AJS, but nothing is as cool to my 19-year-old as being on a podcast that you can download it from iTunes. That's cool.
Well, so, Omar keeps asking me, when can I go on? When can I go on? And I'm like, hold your horses. You know, you haven't quite worked up to that level yet, right?
Well, my daughter thinks my podcast is the least cool thing in existence. So,
Wait, less cool than Lean Cuisine and listening to Wings?
My kids aren't on Twitter, so they don't even know about that. That's Daddy's secret.
Yeah. Daddy's dark secret, second Daddy's life.
I spend my afternoons eating Lean Cuisine and listening to Wings. All right. Vinny, let's start off. Let's talk about your new project coming up, Inequality and Power in Everyday Life. What's the project about?
I've been studying inequality, different kinds of inequality, and across different institutional domains, especially politics, work, education, for a while, and I'm sort of diving into this project as an opportunity to try to put the puzzle pieces together from these sort of different types of inequality, different institutional domains I've been focusing on, and I have the opportunity now to sort of try to pull it all together. I think it's partially a reaction to specialization within the field of sociology, which I appreciate for sort of its empirical value and empirical analyses, but I am a little unnerved by the fact that, you know, sociologists of education don't talk to sociologists of culture, don't talk to sociologists of work, et cetera, when these institutions obviously play off each other. There's also, you know, some unease with the lack of conversation between inequality-oriented sociologists. That is, you know, some focus on race, ethnicity, some focus on immigration, some focus on gender, you know, some focus on social class or LGBT issues, et cetera. And they're not having conversations with each other. I think there are certain, although there are certainly unique dimensions to those types of inequality, I've always been haunted, you know, just despite, you know, the good advice of my advisors to pick one area of sociology and focus on, just publish on that one thing for the next 40 years. I've always had a sort of an unease with not trying to pull it all together. So this book, Inequality and Power in Everyday Life, is that attempt.
I remember the last time I used to love the concept of power. I remember reading up on it when I was an undergrad. Stephen Luke's, I remember, and Dennis Wrong. But I also remember that I haven't really heard about the topic. I remember not reading up much on it in graduate school, and I don't see much about it. Why don't we talk about power more? It's so central. But we don't explicitly theorize on it.
Yeah, it's hard to get our hands around. I mean, even a lot of inequality scholarship, you know, sort of resorts to sort of analyses of group differences, which again is fine, or you know, human capital differences that explain inequalities in this or that. And I think it's unfortunate that especially inequality scholars have lost sight of power. And I think part of the problem is that power operates at multiple levels, right? It operates at a sort of societal level. If you think about the state and who has disparate say over the state, happens at institutional levels, happens at organizational levels, and then happens on face-to-face levels as well. So it's the complexity of it and how it matters relative to inequality is really hard to get our hands around, especially, you know, during the contemporary era of sociology where you know, you have to write a journal article in 30 pages and you have to put together a singular sort of empirical analysis. If you're talking about sort of power and inequality at a societal level, there's no way you're going to do that. So I think that's part of it. It's complex, but I think, you know, to our demise, we're ignoring how power and culture and power are implicated in the reproduction of inequality.
Have we gone much further than Stephen Luke's over the past, I guess, 40 years now, right?
Not too much. I mean, there certainly are social, psychological, and experimental sort of analyses of sort of interactional power in experimental settings. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Luke's was talking about, you know, big power, big P power at sort of the societal level. And I haven't, you know, seen much. I mean, I've gone back and have read what, you know, the articles you've mentioned. I've gone back again, you know, to Weber. And now more recently, I've been really diving into Gramsci. I'm having to go backwards to sort of look for these big statements on power and why it's meaningful. Now there are within more specific literatures, you know, Joan Acker and talks about power in organizations and gender and masculinity. Du Bois certainly talked about race in particular and institutional power at some level and its consequences. So I'm really struggling with it, but it's actually, you know, it's totally terrifying to try to undertake a sort of broad theoretical project like this. But at the same time, I think maybe sociology needs to sort of move out and think big again.
Do you think that maybe power is too big a concept? It's sort of like social structure, right? Or is it possible that it's too big to theorize? Or do you, you know, see sort of a path to victory? Or maybe a path towards useful conceptualization?
Yeah, I've always liked sort of big theory, as long as I can see, you know, avenues by which one might test elements of that theory. So I think one could come up with a perspective on power, you know, or hegemony or whatever terms you like, and apply it to particular institutional domains or organizational practices, et cetera. So I think it is too big for any singular analysis, for sure. But that doesn't mean that we can't sort of theorize it in big ways that might be informative to more meso-level analyses.
Let's talk about empirics. Can you share with us sort of any examples of empirics that you feel are very revelatory, right? That really stand as a really good way of exemplifying the dynamics or character of power.
You know, there are, I think there are really great case studies of sort of power, top-down sort of power dynamics with really serious implications for inequality. There are, you know, at sort of a societal political level. So I've done some work on, you know, like the Wounded Knee Massacre or the subordination of Native Americans, sort of historically, and how power at the state level combined with sort of culture and legitimation to sort of allow the federal government to subordinate, essentially resulting in the reservation sort of era that we still live in. But then there are sort of meso-level analyses. I mean, Charles Tilly's book, Durable Inequality, at some level is about power, although it doesn't tend to use the concept of power so explicitly. Wieden and Grusky's work on social closure in particular occupations and how, you know, certain status groups sort of hone in and protect and by default are excluding others. I can keep going on and on. And then, of course, there are really, you know, Linda Mulm's sort of experimental stuff on power and and the interactional sort of dynamics, how status matters in everyday encounters, how it gets activated either implicitly or explicitly to sort of reify existing arrangements, I've always found fascinating. So there are you know, different, I'm sort of methodologically all over the place in my answer to your question, because I think you'll need different kinds of methodologies depending on the level at which you want to sort of understand power distributions and practices of power and domination.
Yeah, no, I think this sounds like an amazing project, and I actually can't wait to read what I hope will be a not more than 500-page book, right? Although, you know, whatever, I'm especially a fan of your work in education. Mm-hmm. So given how good that work is, if this is anywhere near as good as that, I think I could sit through more than 500 pages. But one of the things that I actually want to get back to, mm-hmm. is the point that you made, Vinny, about how, you know, we are meant to specialize and we are meant to focus on this very, very tiny, like, portion of, you know, of scholarship. And one of the things that I've been finding, for example, in trying to figure out what race means and how it operates, right? Like, you can't just stay looking at one institution.
Right.
You have to look across multiple institutions to see, you know, where the logics, you know, tend to click together. And you're like, aha, right?
Yeah.
This is how it works, right? And I think it's the same. It's the same with trying to figure out what power is. It's the mm-hmm. same with trying to figure out what any of these big concepts that we as sociologists are meant to be concerned with and meant to be, you know, basically defining.
Totally, totally. And I promise, actually, the book's going to be 200 pages or less. That was the pitch I made to Polity, is that like my favorite moments as an undergraduate and a graduate student in sociology were reading those kind of small paperbacks that were filled with theoretical ideas, you know, Tilly's book, like Why, among mm-hmm. others, you know, Peter Berger's Introduction to Sociology. This little paperback probably left a deeper impression on me in terms of my sociological thinking than any particular article. And I'm an article writer, so no insult to the article writers out there. But you're right. I mean, this probably, I could never decide even as a graduate student what exactly I wanted to focus on. I was looking at, you know, economic inequality and published some articles in grad school on economic inequality and race in the South and sort of the constellation of race and class dynamics that were going on simultaneously. And then I remember telling Don Tomaskovic, DV, my advisor, that I now want to focus on education for my dissertation. And he looked at me like I was a little crazy, but he went with the flow. And, and you know, and I studied education, but it wasn't just education I was able to focus on because, you know, educational inequality by race or by social class is also partially a function of, you know, geography and where you live and the politics of the place you live. It's also a function of what happens in families and what's going on in your parents' employment, right? So these institutional domains are interwoven with each other. And I think that the danger of sort of super specialization in the field is that, you know, we end up with useful snapshots of what's going on in a particular domain, but the danger is then you're implicating that one domain, maybe like education is where all the problems of racial inequality sort of come from, which we know is not the case.
Exactly.
Right. So, you know, this is, I'm sort of trying to go back now. This runs counter to where I think some rewards lie in our field. You know,
tell me about it.
If you're an assistant professor and you're going up for tenure, and this is sort of one issue I had, you're going up for tenure, you're expected to put together sort of a research statement, right, to send to the external committee that sort of describes a unifying sort of agenda in your work. That is, you're supposed to have a sort of a specialized focus in it. So in some ways, this is a sort of a dangerous thing I'm saying, right? Think bigger, when in fact the expectation is that you will sort of hone in and specialize in your career, let alone, I mean, how many of us have time to sort of read across multiple literatures, multiple types of inequality, multiple institutional domains. So there's a heavy startup and some potential dangers in doing this.
Yeah, totally.
But I feel like I'm maybe at a point in my career now. Well, what the hell? Let me try and see what happens. But I think the field would benefit from more efforts in these regards to sort of think bigger. And again, power. It just has sort of just fallen by the wayside of a lot of inequality discussion, which is troubling. Mm-hmm. And it's also the case that really we've done an absolutely lousy job at integrating culture and belief in our discussions of inequality. In part, I understand it. They're very hard sort of to capture. You know, how does culture and belief impact, you know, the persistence of race or gender inequality? But, you know, man, look around the world around us. I mean, we were just talking about the incel group, right?
Yeah.
How do we make sense of that? What's going on? You know, what's going on culturally or in terms of people's beliefs? And we know these are important for the way people, you know, treat other people on the street, how they treat people in organizations, how they go out and vote at the end of the day. And so we need to bring belief and culture back into it. So I'm adding on to the interinstitutional focus by suggesting that we need to do a lot better of a job. And that's where sort of Gramsci sort of came in to my rereading and rethinking of some of this. You know, he does balance out sort of old Marxist traditions, which are much more materialist emphasis, by suggesting that, you know, there's a lot of action in culture and belief. And that pertains not only to class, which is what he was talking about, but to race, ethnic inequality, or gender inequality.
I'm hearing you talk about power and different, what I consider to be different forms of power. So, you know, you talked about like Linda Bohm's experiments, where that's basically measuring dependence, where, you know, I have two potential trading partners, so I can play them off against each other, you know, effectively, an experimental operationalization of Emerson 1962, and the kind of thing you can measure with Bonisich 86. You know, and then I also hear you talking about like status. And when I hear status, I think of like, you know, especially in the context of understanding status as power, I think of like, you know, Gould's model, where when someone is of higher status than you, you will accept only partial reciprocity. If someone's an equal, you expect full reciprocity. And if someone is a subordinate, you expect super reciprocity. So, and then on top of that, you're talking about Gramsci, you know, with like notions of like cultural identity, all that sort of thing. And I'm sure we can add in, you know, closer to the Gramsci thing, we could talk in like Bourdieu and cultural capital, also kind of a cultural notion. So yeah. To what extent do we gain anything in a sort of intellectual monism of understanding these as all just special cases of power? And to what extent is it meaningful to think of them as having completely different micro-level heuristics that in some cases may cut against each other? Basically, are you a lumper or a splitter? Or, you know, if you want to think of it another way, are you taking kind of an intellectually monist idea? Or are you just creating like, here's a menagerie of different forms of power, and they're all interesting because they all ultimately get you stuff?
Well, I think at the moment I'm a lumper. Uh-huh. That is I'm at least in this particular project, I want to try to work my way down from the sort of societal to the institutional to the organizational to the sort of interactional. Now that doesn't mean that I've sort of always been there. Actually, part of the reason I wanted to engage in this project is I've been doing a bunch of work over the last 10 years on sort of discrimination and sort of status dynamics as they happen in real workplace environments or in housing, et cetera. So the initial insights to the relevance of power actually began at this sort of micro level, not in an experimental sense, but in a sort of archival or sort of real world sort of account sense of how discrimination happens. I'm starting from the top down. I'm lumping them together. I mean, I do think there are elements of power that might counter one another, but I'm looking at the I think the more general trend in particularly class inequality, race and gender inequality, and I do think they align more than they splinter.
Additional questions on power and inequality, or should we move on? I want to talk about the task force. Yeah.
Oh, you don't want to ask about some R&R you got 10 years ago and that you're still mad about?
You can ask. That's great.
All right, let's do that, and then I'll bring up all my beefs about why I'm not an ASR. So first, Vinny, let's talk about this. You're chairing an ASA task force on first generation and working class sociologists.
Yeah.
This sounds really interesting. Can you tell us what the task force is about?
Sure. This task force came about through some prodding of the council by a number of ASA members. I actually wasn't one of the people that prodded for it, but it sort of intrigued me. You know, there's a lot of work going on right now, both within the sociological literature, the educational literature, but also sort of policy work that universities are doing on first generation students. They're not likely to go to college. They're less likely to finish college, et cetera. I'm engaged in a project on that as well at my university. But the task force itself, the goals are to, number one, to sort of, you know, at least at the basic level, define what we even mean as sociologists by first generation. Do we mean people that whose parents did not have any college? Do we mean working class people whose parents worked, you know, blue collar jobs? Do we mean low income people, et cetera? And we're trying to tease that out because there's actually not a really good definition in the first place, even among universities and how they activate or use the term. So that's sort of one of our tasks, and we're trying to come to some consensus regarding that. But the sort of bigger issue or questions that I think are at stake are whether or not there are, you know, mobility problems, particularly in our profession, relative to those from working class or first generation backgrounds. If there are, where are they? You know, how do people sort of navigate this new terrain of university or sort of faculty life when they're not used to it, and it can seem sort of overwhelming, if not alien to them. And so what we're going to be doing is a lot of things. Actually, beginning this year at ASA, we're going to spend a day doing focus groups with both members of ASA and sociologists, at least in the Philadelphia area, that are not as actively integrated in the profession, that we're going to try to sort of recruit in for the day, to just do some brainstorming with them over what sort of the issues are in their professional lives, in the mobility or lack of mobility they've experienced. Are they experiencing sort of resource problems, et cetera? That's just sort of an initial qualitative undertaking. And then sort of following that, since this is a 3-year task force, I'm going to be busy for a while, as will my 15-member committee, who are awesome. We're going to be surveying sociologists probably within a year, all ASA sociologists. So we have some sort of comparative referent, but we're also going to be recruiting in sociologists who are at like community colleges, for instance, who might not have the resources, energy, or integration into professional societies like ASA, as well as graduate students about problems they've experienced or blockages in the pipeline, et cetera. I mean, I was just talking about institutional, dependence and inequality. And, there's not going to be a sort of a simple answer to what's going on in the mobility prospects. And then following the survey, we're going to be doing in-depth interviewing with hopefully a relatively large sample of respondents to sort of dig deeper and see what other kind of either tangible issues they're experiencing or social psychological issues about fitting in, belonging, garnering positions within the field, you know, visible positions within the field.
Well, I mean, I don't want to push you to speculate too much, but I'm going to. From the outset, what do you feel the issues are? I mean, if someone, you know, gets their degree and they happen to be from foreign born parents or working class parents, what are you missing? How does it disadvantage you concretely?
Well, I mean, we know how it disadvantages, you know, people even earlier in the process from sort of the emerging literature. I mean, as I said, they're less likely to go to college in the first place, let alone finish college. Right. And at least if we think about those that want to go into grad school in sociology, they're probably disproportionately going to go to less prestigious programs, in part maybe because, you know, like the SAT and ACT, they're probably, if they were family disadvantaged, they're going to have lower GRE scores, you know, from the get-go, which we know is sort of a, you know, gatekeeping tool into the more prestigious grad programs. Often there might be sort of resource disadvantages that they experience, student loans and debt and the need to get a job, et cetera. And, you know, that sort of compounds inequalities later down the line. If you graduate from a department that's, you know, 75th in the country, the odds of you getting a high prestige job in the field or going to graduate school in a department that will sort of nurture the kind of vita you need to get a high prestige job in the field has got to be lower. So there are this sort of tangible mobility issues that I hope we can tackle, but also there's a broad literature, not only on obviously first generation working class people, but on minority people about just fitting in a place that seems totally alien. I mean, you're going to have less of the sort of, you know, academic cultural capital from the get go.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, and basically just to chime in as someone who would maybe be a good subject for your study. just to chime in, I could see there are instances where you don't end up in a less prestigious program, but you, when you are in these prestigious programs, I mean, I think that there is language that is taken for granted, right? And I don't mean the kind of language that, you know, that means that you wouldn't get a perfect score on the verbal component of your GRE. I mean, I got that locked down. But just academic language in terms of, what are comprehensive exams? Right. Like, how does this happen? How does that happen? And I think that there is actually, like, very, very often, unless you go to your director of graduate studies, unless you go to your committee members and say, hey, you guys do realize that I'm like first generation, right? And you should maybe give me, when I ask you questions, you shouldn't think that I'm stupid. Yeah. You should just think that maybe I'm just like, I haven't been around this kind of academic culture thing before.
Yeah. It takes a lot of bravery to have that moment, right? You know, first generation students are reluctant or will tend to be reluctant to sort of reveal where they're from because they're trying to fit in. But doesn't mean they're not going to experience that uneasiness, right? And, you know, I suspect, you know, we will, you know, on the one hand, when we're looking or as we're looking at sort of mechanisms of discomfort and or sort of inequality in the mobility process, you know, and a couple of committee members have also talked about the possibility of doing some in-depth interviewing, at least with some of the outliers, some who have made it through the pipeline in successful ways. And what was it? What were those? I mean, we're not used to doing this in sociology, right? We don't study the outliers. But it may be worth looking at. Was it a sort of a key mentor that you felt comfortable talking about or revealing who you were and where you're from along the way? Was it, good interactions and relationships with a cluster within your cohort where you could sort of share your vulnerabilities and seek advice and figure out what comprehensive exams are without fear of embarrassing yourself in front of the, you know, the whole grad cohort, et cetera.
So I have kind of a devil's advocacy question, and I'll preface this by saying it's been like 20 years since I've seriously studied stratification sociology, and so I'm probably messing something up. But when I was studying it, I remember learning that there was an article, I believe by Mike Hout, that established that after you get your bachelor's degree, the net effects, like family background affects whether you get a bachelor's degree. It's a huge influence on whether you get a bachelor's degree. But once you get the bachelor's degree, there's minimal net effects of family socioeconomic status. So assuming that I'm remembering that correctly and assuming that it's still valid and hasn't, you know, doesn't apply to recent cohorts or something, that would imply that for this entire population we're talking about, right? Because we're, by definition, more or less talking about people who finished their bachelor's degree, because we're talking about people who are either in graduate school or have completed graduate school. That would imply that we should expect to see relatively weak effects of family SES background.
Yeah.
But doesn't that depend on the outcome that you're measuring in terms of the effect of family SES?
Yeah, I think he was looking at status attainment or income or something like that.
Right. And I think it was also people with bachelor's degrees that went right into the labor market. And I know there's some debate over those findings and whether they still hold that are going on right now. And, you know, I wonder, you know, I'm open to any possibility, but I wonder if there are not sort of, and there's not an extra layer of a sort of prestige dynamic, resource dynamics that go into those who keep going. I mean, comparing those who get their PhDs, you know, where did they go to school? What kinds of, you know, work related outcomes, status related outcomes do they experience? I think I hope the field is open enough to sort of take a close look at itself to at least assess whether or not there are sort of blockages in the pathways of these populations. But I'm familiar with Hout's article.
Yeah, I just think it's an empirical question. Yeah. And I'm just saying that article would lead us to believe that there should actually be fairly minimal effects. It's an empirical question, and one that's probably worth asking. Yeah. But
it could be, and you know, having the right kind of comparison groups and having we're having these just sort of biweekly discussions about sampling. How are we going to do this survey? So we're comparing, the right people. What kind of markers of success and status do we have? I mean, probably when we survey, we'll ask for people's vitas too, so we know what their pathways were. What their publication records look like. Kind of who got the good book contracts? Who didn't get the good book contracts, who got into ASR, who didn't get into ASR, who became a department chair or, head of this ASA committee or that ASA committee, et cetera.
Wait, is that kind of service work a good or a bad outcome?
This is sort of the debate. I was a little worried. Michelle Lamont asked me to chair this committee, and I sort of thought to myself, Committee on the Status of Race Ethnic Minorities and Committee on the Status of Women. Yeah. So you're going to take some productive people, really productive people in those groups who have some visibility, and you're going to keep them busy doing a whole bunch of bureaucratic work for the ASA now. That's not good. We're going to make, policy suggestions that the ASA might have workshops, once we know what the sort of findings are. But we're also, a good number of us on this committee are planning on publishing in reputable social outlets out of this data we're gathering. I mean, this is really, we're engaging in a pretty monumental data collection sort of effort about our field. But I think the implications will probably carry over to some extent in other fields, certainly other social science fields as well.
Yeah, and it sounds like it'll be interesting. And, you know, I was giving some reasons to expect that you might find the null, but even if you do, that would still be interesting to know.
Totally. I want to know what the storyline is.
All right. And maybe before we let you go, Vinny, one last question that I think a lot of listeners will be wondering about. You have some great experience as editor of ASR. Yeah. What have you learned through that process about writing publishable papers?
I'm still editing a journal, so I haven't gotten to put it in practice yet. No, I think, oh man, I didn't expect this question. So you,
we can drop it.
No, leave that.
Or is it really just the question of write good articles? Like write something new, yeah. Write something good.
Well, if you write, I actually think one thing I've learned sort of along the way, aside from, you know, having the sort of the empirics, right, and interesting and, you know, if not groundbreaking in your article, good writing matters. And this has sort of bothered me for a while because we sort of drill into our graduate students like crazy in their programs. You know, you got to take this methods class, that methods class, this methods class, that methods class. Mm-hmm. But we actually don't train our graduate students in writing, like clear, concise writing, which I think is a shame because I think those types of articles that are well written, but also potentially groundbreaking and make the case and sell themselves well, tend to do better in the review process. I mean, readers are sort of intrigued. So I would say, you know, good sort of concise writing, man, and keep at it. You know, rewrite, get feedback before you submit it.
Well, can I, let me suggest something and then you tell me if it's your consistent with your more extensive experience editing than mine, which is the single most important thing you're going to write is the cover letter, not in the sense of, oh, here's the abstract all over again, or not in the sense of like the kind of boilerplate of it would be a privilege to publish in your journal, but just in the sense, if you're writing to a general interest journal, of saying, my work speaks to these two areas. Here's a list of suggestions of 10 possible reviewers, and make it 10, not 3, so that, you know, they can choose from it without worrying about compromising double blind. Because what I found that does is it tells the editor, or more to the point, it tells the managing editor, right, who's typically a grad student, here's the reviewer pool who will know how to appreciate my research, and don't pick up on some surface similarity that's misleading and send it to someone who's totally inappropriate and therefore won't like it.
I don't know about that. I mean, I'm sure different editors have sort of different takes on it. I've always been relatively hands-on, sort of reading, you know, the intro and the abstract at least, and sort of figuring out, you know, who might be appropriate reviewers or not. And I think for you know, generalist journals, you know, the big generalist journals, sometimes it's worth the time of an editor to pull in a reader, a sort of a broad reader, but somebody who's maybe not as specialized, because there are specialty areas within our field that are really pretty small.
Yes.
And you figure them out pretty quickly as an editor. You know, I mean, it could work to your advantage, but it could also work to your disadvantage if there are 8 people in that particular sub area and 4 of them hate the other 4. Uh-huh. You're kind of screwed in the process. So, you know, I certainly would look and have, you know, historically looked at, you know, cover letters that suggest reviewers. I'll certainly give them a good take, but I also would worry a little bit as an editor that, you know, the author's trying to stack the deck a little bit, to people that they're either know the paper or they think will like the paper. So, you know, I think good editors mix it up. They'll take, you know, they'll look at your suggestions, and then they can take them or leave them. But I do think, actually, relative to at least part of what you said, I think, man, abstract and introductions are the most important thing for getting the kind of reviewers that you want. Because think about it, you know, you get an email from a journal saying, "Would you review this paper?" And the first thing you do is you scroll down and you look at the title of the paper in the abstract, and you make a decision. right? About whether you want to review it or not. And if the abstract looks interesting, relevant, provocative, et cetera, you're more likely to say yes.
Yeah.
If it looks like it's just, you know, boring, then just leave it alone. I don't have time for this. So in some ways, you can create sort of a bit of a positive self-selection on your paper if you really are do a good job on the abstract.
Yeah, I personally... In particular, the works cited section first, but that's because I've read Joel Podolny. But I agree with you that most people go to the title and the abstract first, and that's how they get their idea of whether this is a paper worth reviewing. Yeah. And also, even if they agree to review it, just what sets their expectation of like, oh God, this is going to be a slog, or oh, I'm looking forward to see what this has to say.
For more, visit us on the web. TheAnnexPodcast.com.